Good evening and welcome to Dalek Radio for the weekend of the 6th and 7th of February. Once again, we will be quizzing the United Kingdom Independence Party once more, and we have Barry Harding live in the studio. Anthea Page will be taking a look at Bristol's Holocaust Memorial Services. We also have another episode of some rustic reminiscences. Yes, it's Hedge Trimmings, read by Malcolm Greaves. And we also have the second part of the feature on the Temple Local History Group. And this week we discuss conduits. Our reporter Tony Gosling was down at the Avon Valley Railway in Bitton last week for a rare treat to see a restoration of one of the world's first locomotives, Stevenson's famous Rocket, being put through its paces. And we also have Trevor, the Bard of Windmill Hill. We can't forget him, and he's got his weekly poem. But it's now time to hand over to Tony Gosling.
Thanks, John. Barry Harding, welcome to Dialect.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here this evening.
Now, you're standing in the forthcoming general election, is that right? Where is that?
I am indeed, and I'm standing in Somerton and Frome, which is just a little bit south of Bristol.
Now, UKIP is one of the smaller parties, and we've got a first-past-the-post voting system. So, surely a UKIP vote is a wasted vote?
Well, that's one way of looking at it, but back in June, UKIP actually came second. The Conservatives got 28% of the vote, UKIP got 17%, Labour got 16%, Lib Dems got 14%, Greens 8% and BNP 6%.
But that was in the European elections, wasn't it, which is a different voting system. What I'm saying is that the first-past-the-post system actually means that most of the votes, if UKIP gets votes, which I'm sure it will, but most of those votes are then thrown away.
They're not thrown away because UKIP, for example, in Somerton and Frome, tips the balance. David Heath, the Lib Dem MP, has a majority of under 1,000. So it's going to be pretty critical. And I'm certainly in the business of persuading Lib Dems that they are going to do better voting for UKIP than for the Conservatives, and the other way around, the Conservatives, they're better voting UKIP than they are Lib Dem. So we will see, but certainly I don't expect to see all 450 UKIP candidates getting into Westminster, and of course I'd be in cloud cuckoo land if I did.
So what is the point of voting for the UK Independence Party? Because essentially, if you're at Westminster, if you get an MP, for example, what would you be doing at Westminster? Because essentially, you're a European organisation, aren't you?
No, we're not at all. We originated by saying that our policy was we wanted to get out of the EU. But now we have a whole raft of policies which are based upon fairness and representing what the electorate actually wants rather than what MPs decide they should have. It also believes in certainly reducing the size of the bureaucracy and doing away with Big Brother around every corner, which is the way that we seem to have gone over the last 15 years or so.
Now, 2 weeks ago, UKIP announced that it wanted to ban the burqa. Now, what has this got to do with the European Union and a policy towards the EU?
Precisely. That's exactly the point I'm trying to make, that we have policies which go way beyond that of simply getting out of the EU.
But if you're talking about fairness, I mean, surely people should be able to wear whatever they want. What's that got to do? Why should politicians be telling people what to wear?
Because the majority of people are uncomfortable with burqas. The most recent survey, which I think was yesterday, showed that about 56% were in favour of a ban on burqas in public places. A couple of reasons for that. One, it's the British way to look people in the eyes, as I am doing with you right at this moment, and judging the reaction of what you're saying, and that is one way that we have produced our civilization over the years. Secondly, and probably even more important than first, there is a safety element here. Bombers have actually secreted things under burqas. They are very all enveloping garments, and there's quite a threat there. One bomber actually has got away wearing a burqa.
I think you will find probably that most bombs over the years have been planted by people who are not wearing burqas. But anyway, I mean, if someone's talking and conversing on the radio with someone in a burqa, you wouldn't even know, would you?
No, certainly. but that would be your choice as to whether you thought there was a threat to your studio or not. People are not allowed to wear crash helmets going into banks. So what is quite so different? We're talking about safety here.
Well, that's yes, but banks are private property, and the ban on burqas we're talking about, this is a public thing.
Well, there are quite a few places now that ban hoodies, both in public places, if you like, their stores, their malls, and I certainly feel uncomfortable if there's someone wearing a burqa near me in one of the Bristol malls.
Well, we've got many Muslims living in Bristol. Don't you think you're fostering a culture of paranoia?
Not at all. The burqa is not in the Quran. Many Muslims believe that it is not even part of the Islamic religion. Certainly, I've spent quite a lot of time in Pakistan, and the burqa was not normally seen on the streets anywhere that I was, and I was in most of the major cities in Pakistan, from Islamabad, Karachi, Lahore, and I worked actually for the Pakistani government there, and certainly it was not an issue. Similarly, while we're on the subject, the national language in Pakistan is English. And if you want to do business with the government, you speak English. There are no translations of all the documentation into other languages.
But don't you think that Hindus, Muslims, Jews, whoever, should just be able to choose how they interpret their religion?
As long you
clearly don't.
As long as it does not damage our culture or cause a threat to our way of living.
Okay, so you really think the burqa is damaging British culture?
It could do, and it could certainly damage British lives.
Okay, you have quite some experience in the civil service, you were saying before
yep.
we came on. Can you tell us why that's led you to be suspicious and really against Brussels and the European Union?
Yes, I certainly can. I have represented the UK at a certain level in many, many meetings. I have sat in international meetings behind an EU representative who's spoken on behalf of the UK and the other EU states. And I have also been to a lot of meetings in Brussels to formulate the kind of stance or policy that should be taken. I've also sat next to ministers and seen them bounced. There's no other word for it. Our steel industry...
Well, how do you mean? Can you just explain?
Yes, that? I can. I was just about to. If you take an example of that, the UK steel industry in the early 90s was doing rather well. The Italians, the Spaniards, the French, and even the Germans were struggling because of East Germany. They all wanted to subsidise against the letter of the law in the EU, their steel industries. Now, we had every right to stand there and refuse to allow them to have those subsidies, because at a time of overproduction, you certainly want your competitors to go to the wall. Instead, our ministers made compromises which allowed the subsidies to take place, and I think we've now bearing the results of that, with the British steel industry taking a real hammering because of those compromises. And the British ministers concerned were virtually put in a corner, and something which the Foreign Office does not like is being isolated in the EU, and that is what happened. And that is just one example.
But don't you think it's possible that steel is being produced much more efficiently in other parts of the world, and this is rather sour grapes because we are actually not as efficient anymore?
We were certainly very efficient. What has happened with the steel mill in Teesside is all about carbon credits, and that is where it is in the interests of Mr. Mittal to close. Mr. Mittal has an interest in that, but it's also Tata, have an interest in closing a mill and getting credits for it so they can then produce the steel in India or Malaysia or wherever. So, no, it was not about efficiency. It was about manipulation of figures and money.
Finally, going back to this burqa business, don't you think that this is likely, people are likely to associate in their minds, associate you with these thuggish elements like the English Defence League, people who are protesting and campaigning at mosques against what they call the Islamification of Britain?
If they do, they are mistaken. We are a non-racial party. We have a number of Asians actually standing and representing UKIP in councils. We may even have some PBCs.
Some what?
Would be candidates for the general election.
What does it stand for, PBC?
It's a provisional parliamentary candidate.
Okay. Right, Barry Harding, UKIP candidate in the forthcoming election for Somerton and Froome, at least we hope you are. Thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Can I just give you one quote, which I think is perhaps...
Go on then.
The more corrupt the state, the more it legislates. And that is Tacitus. So it's about 2,000 years old. And bearing in mind that the EU has produced something like 100,000 directives so far, then I think that that's quite a relevant and apposite quote.
Barry Harding, thanks very much.
Thank you.
I'd like to introduce to the studio Sima Kalimi. Hello.
Hello there.
In recent times, we've chatted to you in regard to your being on the convoy to Gaza, but we're here to chat about Iran today. So how long have you been in the UK and how long were you in Iran for initially?
Well, I left Iran in the 70s, late 70s, just before the revolution.
Okay.
And I was in my 20s when I came over.
Yeah. What led you to, might be an obvious question, but what led you to leave?
Nothing. There was a student exchange program at the time, and I came over to England to study.
Okay, so latterly, did you think, oh, that's quite lucky, missed the revolution, that's quite good, or did you miss it?
No, I was actually really looking forward to the revolution, and I did in fact go back immediately after the revolution to see how things have changed in Iran.
Okay, so for people who are a little bit ignorant about Iran, what did the revolution mean for Iranian people?
Well, you have to remember that just before the revolution, we had a monarchy and one-party monarchy system. So it was a really exciting time to see that, you know, things have changed or are changing. The revolution is happening, and it was really very much a brave new world for all of us.
Mm-hmm. I mean, bearing in mind with the reputation of Ahmadinejad, and as he's seen by the West, they portray him as being a little bit of a fascist dictator. I mean, how do you think democracy has been working out in Iran for the past couple of decades?
Well, it has had a lot of ups and downs, democracy in Iran. And immediately after the revolution, it was very exciting times because all sort of organizations were active, all sort of ideologies were competing with each other. And in the end, we had Islamic government sort of dominating the politics, and ever since it has been in power. Mm. But you know, it has been up and down. We have had reformists in power. We have had more strict Islamic regime in power.
Do you feel disappointed by the way things have turned out, or are you still quite hopeful for the future?
Well, no, I'm definitely hopeful for the future. Not so much disappointment, really, because what is happening at the moment is very much dictated by the attitude of the international community, especially the West towards Iran. So it is a real politique at the moment.
I mean, a lot of the reputation of Iran seems to rest around the fact that America doesn't seem to like Iran at all. What problems have they got? I mean, they're a democracy. Isn't it better to have good relations? They seem very...
Yes, I think American and American Iran have had a rocky relationship, obviously, since the revolution. But most of it, I think, is a bit false, because Americans regard Iran as this demon state.
Indeed.
In the middle of, a friendly, what they regard as a friendly region. Most of the countries in the region are pro-Americans, and Iran out there is independent democracy, the only democracy really in the Arab world, in the Middle East, other than Israel.
Okay, I mean, we're told that they're aiming to have a nuclear bomb. I mean, presumably that makes Iran quite dangerous.
Well, if that was true, yeah. Right. Although with other countries going nuclear and having been nuclear for a while, you can understand why they would, Iranian regime would want to defend itself.
Yeah.
But even IAEA has not found any evidence of Iran wanting to develop nuclear missiles. But nuclear energy, yes, Iran is entitled, like any other country, to develop its nuclear energy.
Okay. I mean, the recent Chilcot inquiry, Tony Blair was asked, why did you not plan well for what was going to happen in Iraq, after, especially Basra and stuff like that, and things sort of fell to pieces. And he said, but it's Iran to blame, not my lack of planning. Mm-hmm. They exacerbated difficulties, and we had no idea that they're going to, be as bad as they were, without really specifying anything specific. What do you think he was referring to?
I don't know, because I think, to be honest, for me, his evidence, especially regarding Iraq, was, completely in a cloud cuckoo land here. it had no connection with reality at all. And as far as the Iranian attitude and policy in the region is concerned, I think it is every nation's right to be friendly with their neighbors, yeah, and have a relationship. And that is what Iran is having with Afghanistan and Iraq.
I mean, with democracy has come a little bit of influence from Western culture. I think music and culture mostly are what I'm thinking, especially the youth. Do you think the youth will accept authoritarianism or all that kind of rule? Where do you think, they're going to be the leaders of tomorrow. How do you think the young people in Iran are?
Ironically, the generation, post-revolution generation, is to some extent more westernized and knows about the Western culture than we did back in the 70s. And when you look at the Iranian music scene, for example, you see a lot of music, including rap, including hard rock, including traditional music, which have been developed in the post-World Revolution, coming out of Iran. And there are very, very good groups coming out. I mean, one of them is like Kiosk, which is now in America, but it was an underground band in Iran for a long time.
Right. I mean, I suppose a stereotype of what people believe about Iran would be that, it's a heavily religious sort of place. I mean, having lived in Britain and experienced Western culture, do you find the youth are, how religious do you think they are compared to sort of Western? I mean, a lot of people in America are actually quite religious.
Absolutely. I think religion always plays a part in the life of Iranians, but not as big a part as people over here imagine it.
Right.
For Iranians, for example, strict fanatical Islam doesn't really mean as much as the Western people think it does. So they are into music, they are into cultural events, they're into cinema, painting,
And so they're not so very different from us in many respects.
Not at all.
And lastly, I kind of wanted to touch on something that I struck as curious. A photograph of some Iranians marching through the capital, and they were sort of had slogans of anti-British sentiment, but it said, you know, death to the English. And I thought that was quite curious. Mm-hmm. They'd noted the difference between England and British. Is there a deal behind that? Is there a particular anti-English?
No, I think if you ask any Iranian what you think about the Western powers or the English or Americans, they very clearly distinguish between British or English people and their government. It's true about Americans as well. That is why after 9/11, they came out, they had a vigil for the American victims of 9/11, and they sympathize a lot with that, with the American communities.
Okay. Oh well, that's really interesting. It's strange that, you know, we only get one side of the story in the press, as ever. Oh, well, thank you very much for coming in today, Sue Mac, and I hope that we can hear from you more in the future.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Our next feature is by Anthea Page and is about the 65th Memorial Day for the liberation of Auschwitz on the 27th of January 1945.
I'm in Bristol Cathedral and you can hear the music of Howard Davison, which has been composed for a special event, and I'm here with...
Canon Wendy Wilby. I'm Canon Residentiary at the Cathedral here in Bristol.
And can you tell us about today, what special day it is?
Yes, on the 27th of January every year we always remember the liberation of Auschwitz, Holocaust Memorial Day. And in fact it's special this year, 65 years. I can't believe it's 65 years, but it is. And we've got a special event at 5:15, which is not a service as such. It actually will incorporate new music by Howard Davison, the piece that's just in the background, just stop now, called The Guests, but also an arrangement of Messiaen's The Abyss of the Birds, which is most exciting. Apart from that, we've got a Jewish cantor, Robert Hurst, singing, and a klezmer clarinetist, Dan Gooley. We've got the choristers as well. They would be normally singing at this point, and they're going to sing for us tonight as well.
And how do you think people generally in Bristol have commemorated today?
There's been all sorts going on. I should think every church would have had prayers for Holocaust Memorial Day. But I suspect for a place of worship like this to do an event like this, which is something which everybody of no faith or every faith could be a part of, that it's, you know, it's quite something really. We're very pleased with what's happening.
Yeah, I'm Robert Hurst. And I'm singing here today at the cathedral as a Jewish cantor.
And can you tell us what this day means for you?
It means an enormous amount to me. Personally, as a Jew, obviously, it connects with my past all the way back. It connects with all my family who came out of Russia escaping pogroms in the early part of the 19th century, well, later part of the 19th century. And obviously what happened in the war years. But also, I feel Holocaust Memorial Day is an incredible time to think about all the other atrocities that have happened throughout history and in our own lifetime. So much has happened in our own lifetime in the last, you know, few years, 20, 30 years or so. It's a great thing that they decided to make an annual Memorial Day of this kind. Jews actually have another day. Jews do have another day called Yom HaShoah, which actually specifically thinks about the Nazi atrocities. But today is a much wider day, I think, for all kinds of other situations and persecutions. And it's just brilliant that we have time to sit and think about it, because what man does to man, or humankind does to humankind, is sometimes pretty alarming and dreadful. And it's a good to have a day a year to think about that, isn't it?
Howard Davidson.
Can you tell us about your new work that you've composed for this event?
Yes. Because we've actually got several clarinetists available, I decided that it would be a waste not to write a piece for them. As a composer, I'm always looking for, you know, an opportunity to write something. And I got the OK for that to write for seven clarinets, I thought would be good. because that's a reasonable number, and I then set about looking for something to do with them, and I thought, I look for a poem. So I looked for a poem among my favourite poets, is Leonard Cohen. And I found a poem called The Guests. I read that, showed it to several other people as well, just for approval, because it's quite a sensitive subject, and I wanted to make sure that it was okay. I got the general okay, and I set about setting it.
And what inspired you particularly about today?
Well, the chance to be involved in something that I think is extremely important. This legacy of hope. I think that I'm continually appalled by man's inhumanity to man, and I'd like to contribute to something that actually makes us remember that we shouldn't do this.
And what better way than music?
I think at times like this, when things are rather difficult, people turn to music and poetry. I think they turn to the arts to actually try and reflect what feelings one has, because they're usually quite difficult to formulate, or difficult to think about.
When you were composing this piece, did you feel quite emotional about it? The thought behind it?
I felt very pleased that I was doing it, because I liked the words so much. Most of it flowed really well, actually. So it all fell into place really quite quickly, and I enjoyed it. Didn't have to change very much. I followed the sort of song pattern when he turned it into a song, not quite as big as the song, and nothing like the song itself. So it is really a setting of his words. And I did actually have to write to him, or write to his management, and they both replied within 48 hours saying that this was a good thing to do. I got permission, and I can even record it for my own archive purposes, which I was very pleased about, because if anybody was going to object to this sort of use, or writing it for this sort of occasion, it was going to be him.
And thank you very much to Anthony Page for producing that feature. Our reporter Tony Gosling was down at the Avon Valley Railway in Bitton last week for a rare treat to see a restoration of one of the world's first locomotives, Stephenson's famous Rocket, being put through its paces.
Yeah, hello, I'm Bill Parker. I'm the owner of the company that's just built this working replica of Stephenson's Rocket for the National Railway Museum.
So why is it here?
It's here because, having just built it, we need to run it in. It's old-fashioned engineering, and unlike today's modern cars, cars from 10 or 20 years ago used to have to be run in carefully for a few miles to make sure they worked, and we're doing exactly the same with Rocket, but it's using engineering from 180 years ago, so naturally it needs running in that much longer. We were originally commissioned to replace the boiler on an existing replica of Rocket that was already owned by the National Railway Museum. Unfortunately, when we started the job, we discovered that the boiler was the wrong shape and the wrong size from the original, because since the first replica had been built, research had been undertaken that showed it was significantly wrong. So basically, we built a new engine and just used the old wheels and cylinders from the previous model.
So whereabouts did this actually take place? Where did you do the restoration?
We have a little factory in the Forest of Dean, in a place called the Flower in Bream, which is an old colliery engine house, in fact a power station, a generating station to generate electricity for pumps, which is pretty much ideal for conversion into a railway workshop, which is what it now is.
So the Rocket is now chugging backwards and forwards here on the line. How long is it going to have to do that for until you're satisfied it's been properly run in?
Well, ideally I think we'd run it in for 20 or 30 miles, and we've basically got about a mile, so one round trip is 2 miles, and we've probably done 7 or 8 round trips today, and we'll probably do another 7 or 8 round trips. And if nothing else goes wrong, we'll be confident that it won't embarrass us when we deliver it to our client in York at the weekend.
So why did you choose the Avon Valley Railway rather than the railway that there is? There's already one in there, isn't there, in the Forest of Dean?
Yes, there's a railway at the Dean Forest Railway, which runs into the woods from Lydney. Unfortunately, the Dean Forest Railway is, they're repairing their track, and we weren't able, as a result, to get to an attractive part of the line where we could have run straight without having to go across points or level crossings. Whereas the beauty of the Avon Valley is that they gave us permission to use their line going down to the very beautiful Avon Bridge down at the bottom end of their line. And of course, they have a wonderful cafeteria, so one on every point.
What's your interest in restoring old engines like this? And this is, am I right in thinking, this is actually the oldest design of engine in the world?
Not quite the oldest design, but it's the oldest, it was the first successful intercity train. All the engines built before it were built to drag coal or freight from some coal mine in the north of England to the River Tyne or the River Weir or the River Tees. But the Liverpool and Manchester Railway was the first intercity railway built to connect two major cities. And they advertised for an engine that could actually basically do the job of running express trains or the first express trains between two cities. Rocket won that competition. The Stevensons and their partner got a £500 prize, which was worth a lot of money in 1829. And the rest is history.
So how did you get into this?
Well, like everybody of my generation, I was born in 1948, so I was a schoolboy in short trousers at the end of the railway platform in the late 50s and early 60s. And I suppose I fell in love with the England, the engineering, the industrial archaeology, if you like, of that time. And I've been lucky enough to be able to pursue it into old age.
What about this particular model, though? Can it actually pull coaches still? And if so, how many people?
Yes, I mean, it can do exactly what the original Rocket can do. It was built to pretty much the same standard, to the same design as Mr. Stevenson's Rocket in 1829. And that could run at speeds of up to 30 miles an hour, and certainly it could pull 40 or 50 tons, and no reason why this one can't do the same.
Ultimately, where is this going to be used? Or is it going to be just a museum piece?
No, it's the property of the National Railway Museum in York, and it will be used to give demonstration rides in York to the visitors to the National Railway Museum. And on occasions, it will probably travel abroad to demonstrate the best of British engineering, 19th century style.
Thank you very much to Bill Parker for being interviewed there, and to Alex Tony Gosling for that feature on the Avon Valley Railway. Well, last week we heard how Bristol's Temple Local History Group started back in the 1980s about Bristol's medieval city and history of the monks' freshwater systems called conduits. These tunnels, with a pipe running along the floor, still run under the city's streets, and some of them have been delivering fresh water for over 700 years. This week, the group's founder, Julian Lee Jones, explains how he became one of the city's experts on St. John's Conduit, which starts on Brandon Hill and emerges next to St. John's Church in Nelson Street.
I'm Julian Lee Jones, and I'm the chairman and founder of Temple Local History Group, which we founded on May 1980.
Now, you've written a book on St. John's Conduit. What inspired that? How come you got interested in it?
Embarrassment. I was doing, when we were running the history group, I was doing a talk on street furniture and street scene and history of Bristol, and I felt we'd been researching this for about 10 years, so we knew an awful lot about it. No, sorry, 4 years. And I'd checked out and I'd walked around and had this party of people, and we walked around, and as I walked around the corner to St. John's, and I said, and here is the water flowing out of this tap in the wall. It's been flowing like this uninterrupted for 700 years. And of course it was bone dry, red face. So we had to try and find out why. And then we realised there was very little documented evidence. There were some Victorian plans. The plans were quite good, but it was very difficult to relate them to modern-day Bristol, 20th century Bristol. And the other thing was that the descriptions that went with them were Victorian hyperbole. What I mean by that is one instance we found, and it described a spiral staircase descending 18 foot to the Sylvan Grotto. In actual fact, it was a flight of steps going down 8 foot, steps just straight. And it was things like that. So we then started to have to research ab initio almost to work our way through and find out what had happened. And of course, a lot of records had been lost during the war. The record office turned up trumps on all sorts of arcane bits of information for us, which we were able to piece together.
Now, Exeter is a similar kind of medieval city. Did you actually go to Exeter to have a look at the existing conduits in Exeter?
Oh, yes. When he started researching this and looking into other systems, they were one of our benchmarks and they were extremely helpful. And, of course, they have actually opened theirs and made it into a tourist attraction.
Now, there are other conduits as well. St John's runs from the pretty much the top of Park Street down to Nelson Street, but there are some other ones which run even further, aren't there?
Oh, well, there's the ones from the Boiling Wells at Ashley Down that ran down to the eventually to the Key Pipe, which is Eagle House on the centre, on the corner of the centre, opposite the Cenotaph and St Stephen's Street. And some of those, of course, were the St John's Conduit, we'll refer to it as that, were in lead pipes, massive 2-3 inch diameter lead pipes, which are buried deep underground, out of reach of anybody. But the other ones were elm conduits. And there was elm trees that were hollowed out, complete elm trees, and sort of tapered and like a pencil point and socketed into each other. And they used to have problems there because the conduit at Ashley Down was at the conduit head where it gathered the water from the springs was open, and cats used to fall in and plug up the pipes, which was less than pure water coming out the other end.
The other thing is that these pipes were still operating, weren't they? At least St John's certainly was during the Second World War.
It was the main source of water for the parishioners during the bombing, when the bombing had destroyed the water mains. And they say there's a plaque there on the outside of the by the spring out the water outlet, the tap, explaining the value of this to the water and how everybody depended on this medieval conduit.
So what is the Temple Local History Group up to nowadays?
Well, we now act as a research group amongst ourselves, sharing knowledge. We don't run regular meetings anymore, but what we do have is a much better system from the research. We have people both around Bristol and around the world who, through the website and through direct contact, share and just contribute research, and so we share knowledge. For instance, we have one member who is going through and redoing and resurveying all the parish boundary marks and surveys that we did for the city back in the late 80s. And for the last 18 months, he's been going around doing that. Somebody else is researching the tunnel and the conduit systems. Other people are researching industrial processes, chemical works. Some other group of people are researching time systems.
As a city, what is Bristol like as a sort of source for history?
Absolutely saturated with history, but it's still a challenge to find some of the sort of lesser known facts, and also sometimes correcting historical inaccuracies, or we now have better information, we have better research methods. Sometimes you come up with absolutely amazing things. I mean, when I did that book, Bristol Curiosities, wrote there about the doctor in Clifton who did he believed that consumption was caused by excessive drinking of green tea, and he imported thousands of frogs. He wanted to carry out some experiments, and the frogs were brought in from Shropshire, and the barrel of frogs broke and fell off the crane on the dock, and all these thousands of frogs escaped. Well, you know, you couldn't write fiction that meets is as zany as Bristol history at times.
Julian Lee Jones there, one of the founders of the Temple Local History Group, talking to Dialect's Tony Gosling. And you can find the group on the internet at www.history4u.info. So that's history, the number 4, and the letter U. History4u.info.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
It's now time for Malcolm Greaves to read another episode of Hedge Trimmings.
Hedge Trimmings by A.G. Street. The Wood. The other day, life presented me with one of those problems which cannot be dodged. It had to be solved, and I had to decide my own conduct in connection with it unaided. It does not matter what it was. Each of us at times is faced with similar difficulties. In this case, I was not merely annoyed. I had been hurt, unjustifiably, I considered. With the result that I was seething with rage. Nothing to brag about, I admit, but a very human reaction. However, experience has taught me that it is impossible for a man to find the correct solution of any difficulty when he is in that state of mind. So I took my troubles with me and walked up to the wood. From the top of my farm, this wood spreads along the ridge of downs in a westerly direction for some 7 or 8 miles, varying in width from 1 mile to 3. It has been a permanent background to my life and possibly the one thing in it which has not shrunk in size, importance or dignity as I have grown older. That immense field in which I learnt to ride on a fat, lazy pony is now only a small paddock. That wide river across which I puffed with terror-stricken, frantic breaststroke, seems now to be merely a narrow brook. So it is with almost every scene of my childhood. Middle ages dwarfed them out of all recognition. But the majesty of the wood remains unaltered. As I wandered slowly through it, the terrific importance of my trouble seemed to fade away. The peace of the wood and the comfort of the still trees soon ironed out the creases in my soul, and presently I was able, in a contemplative fashion and a tranquil frame of mind, to view my problem in its right perspective. Such a trivial thing it then seemed. In a few years' time, probably in a few months, it would be forgotten. Once again, my friend the wood had not failed me. Willy-nilly, its permanent majesty forced me to realise that the solution of my trouble could only be found in a calm belief in ought and must. This ought to be done, and that must be done. And so I worked it out. This done, I was free to enjoy the beauties of the wood. To some these may have been almost non-existent, for it was January, but to me they are abundant at any season of the year. I love the wood. Having lived in all my life on a farm, enjoying it, I know it in all its moods. I admire its varying beauties and I appreciate its peace. Even so early in the year, I was able to find a flowering primrose in a sheltered corner, a foretaste of the many beauties soon to come. I found it, I admired it, and, write this down to my credit, I did not pick it. Why should I? Its discovery was enough. I left it blooming there to gladden the heart of the next comer. By doing so, I lost nothing, and surely he or she gained something. In these difficult times, a farmer has to be mainly a materialist if he would gain a living from his farming. I know this to be true, but when I am in the wood, I forget that I have a farm. I scarcely know how to put this into words, but the wood holds me, and I realise that I am in the presence of something beautiful and fine. Can anyone find the lamb's tails on the hazel in early spring without experiencing a thrill at the discovery that nature is waking up once again? In due season, The brown leafy carpet of the wood is dappled with yellow primroses in a pattern which excels any modern design. And later on, when the trunks of the trees rise from a mist of bluebells, who does not catch his breath at the glory of it? A glory so beautiful that to look at it almost hurts. Those are the wood's most obvious beauties, but the beauty of its peace is the greatest of all. On the windiest day, when you enter the wood, this peace immediately enfolds you. You feel safe, even as the trees in the wood must feel safe. Today, this leafy sanctuary seems to be the one place in which the noise of modern road transport does not exist. For even when an occasional mechanical vehicle travels the rough road through the wood, its impudent clamour cannot disturb the serene dignity of the tall trees. I watched the tractor hauling timber along that road the other day, and the wood seemed to smile on it pityingly and say, "Don't think you are at all important. You are merely hauling my timber away, a process which has been going on for centuries. You are my servant, and there is no need to make such a fuss over a simple routine job." As the tractor crept slowly along, it seemed cowed by the tall trees on either side of the road. I was conscious of the wood. I saw the load of timber moving steadily along, but I scarcely noticed the tractor. The wood calmly absorbs these new inventions into its service and carries on, undisturbed. For hundreds of years, practically every inhabitant of the valleys on either side has received many benefits from the wood. It has provided the firewood for every household, both large and small. A goodly proportion of men have been employed by it, either as woodmen or keepers, and it has given much good sport to its owners, to their friends, and perhaps, what is more important, to their neighbours of all classes. But in addition to these material things, the wood has provided, and continues to provide, many other precious things for all who dwell within reach of it. Little children are taken there by their parents in order that they may gather flowers. A few years later, they escape from parental control to go birds nesting. In a moment or two, judging time by the wood's history, these same children use it as a sanctuary for lovers. And in the fullness of time, these lovers bring their children to the wood that they may gather flowers in their turn. And so it goes on. I do not think that either my neighbours or myself value the wood sufficiently. We are apt to take it all rather too much for granted. It is, it always has been, and it always will be. We cannot imagine this neighbourhood without that vast black shadow along the top of the downs. But were the wood to be cut down, most of us would feel that we had been hurt in our inmost souls. Such an outrage would leave a gap in our lives too awful even to contemplate. It may seem curious to some when I say that I am glad that the security of the wood, for all our delight, rests upon private ownership. Surely such a valuable thing in the life of a community should be in the hands of some public authority. What would this mean by comparison with the present state of things? Today, under private ownership, the wood is somewhat inaccessible. You can drive a car up that rough, flinty road, but most motorists have too much respect for tyres and springs. The same applies to the cyclist, and in addition, this visitor must push his bicycle for at least 2 miles uphill. I grant you that the horseman can get to the wood easily, but in these days, few of us can afford a horse. So the majority of us walk to the wood and take our tea with us. This inaccessibility makes the wood more valuable. One has to earn its delights, and they are well worth the effort. But, mark you, under existing conditions, the delights of the wood are free to all who value them sufficiently to earn them in this fashion. Under public ownership, the wood would become accessible immediately. There would be a wide, tarred road running through it. Buses and charabancs would be able to provide a regular transport service. There would be petrol filling stations, restaurants, gramophones, wireless sets, crowds, cars innumerable, and noise unspeakable. I may be old-fashioned, but I cannot think that such a change would be real progress.
And that was Malcolm Greaves reading another episode of Hedge Trimmings. Ah, well, it's time for his ultimate bardness, the Bard of Windmill Hill, and here he is to wow us with some poetry. Hello.
Hello, John. Mr. Blair's been in the news again this week with the Chilcot inquiry, so I thought it seems timely to have an obituary for Mr. Blair. I think it is an incredible contribution to our recent history. So this is kind of looking back on that. Blair, smiley, wily, debonair. Oh, what gravitas, oh, what flair, yeah, Blair was our national chair. Teflon-coated, there's nothing he could not repair. He'd reassure as he walked on air. Yeah, yeah, that was Blair. He said we'd all be rich and get our share. That's how he ensnared us, did Tony Blair. Some said, bloody liar, yeah? He sent our boys off over there to fight in desert wars and dare to say it was all right and fair. And then repeat it with a manic stare. He led us into deep despair. Yeah, that was our boyo, Tony Blair. He never went to Weston-super-Mare, but had friends on France's Riviera. Yet for all his faults, beyond compare, unscathed and undefeated, yeah? He always was a pro, you know. His smile could glance off any blow. He dazzled in the media glare, was clever and had style to spare, could sparkle just like Fred Astaire. Now he's got another job somewhere. He'll soon be a multimillionaire, giving speeches and consulting, yeah. Still, although he made some people swear, his talent is supremely rare. He has survived the wear and tear. Don't you agree? Fair's fair, yeah? There'll never be another Blair. And so perhaps I'll leave it there.
Well, well, a poem about Call Me Tony. Well, thank you very much to Trevor Carter, the Bard of Windmill Hill.
Thank you, John.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
It's time for our bad boy boogie monster, Mr. Jeff Sparks, to tell us what's going on. Wagwan, Jeff.
Thank you, John. Good evening. This is your What's On Guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Wednesday, 10th of February, Igloo and Hartley will be performing with support from the Politics at the Thekla in Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. Tickets are £8 in advance. Moving on to Thursday, 11th of February, and Nebula will be performing with support from Merrick and also Rings Around Saturn at the Croft in Stokes Croft, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £10 in advance. Into Friday, 12th of February, and GBH Big Band will be performing a mix of swing, soul and blues at the Prom Bar in Gloucester Road, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £2 on the door. On to Song of the Week and a feature at Nazareth. This group formed in Dunfermline in 1968 and to this day are still recording and touring. This song was originally released in 1973 on the album Razamanaz and is titled Broken Down Angel.
Yeah.
That was Nazareth with Broken Down Angel from the album Razamanaz. For more information, you can check out www.nazarethdirect.co.uk. Now I come to Saturday, 13th of February, and Doreen will be performing at Fiddler's in Railway Street in Bedminster, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £8 in advance. On Sunday, 14th of February, the Teddy White Band will be performing rock and soul covers at the Beehive, which is at 55 Prospect Hill in Swindon. The gig starts at 3 p.m. and entry is free. Finally, on Tuesday, 16th of February, Nazareth will be performing with support from Crossfire at the Tunnels, which is at Bristol and Exeter Mews near Temple Mead Station in Bristol. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £17.50 in advance. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
And there he goes, boogieing off into the sunset. Thank you, Jeff Sparks. Well, good heavens, that's all for this week's show. Dialect is a weekly podcast produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community 93.2 FM across Bristol at 9 o'clock every Saturday evening and repeated at 12 noon the next day on Sunday. If you're on the internet, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or download our podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. You can also find us at bristol.indymedia.org.uk every Thursday evening, or you can listen live on the internet at bcfm.org.uk. Thank you to our studio guests, Barry Harding from the United Kingdom Independence Party, that title in full, Shiamak Alimi for talking about Iran, and to the inimitable Jeff Sparks for his What's On guide. Thank you also to the Bard of Windmill Hill, Mr. Trevor Carter, and to the honeyed tones of Malcolm Greaves. Reporters this week were Anthea Page and Tony Gosling. Studio production was by Johnny Royden and Andy Gordon, and the producer was Tony Gosling. Dialect is a Bristol Radio Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, either in reporting or in engineering, or if you'd just like to come along and see the show being recorded, please get in touch via Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, or on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. Next week, we have Charles Thompson, the sports journalist, as was, and he's going to chat about what that was like being a sports journalist in London. That was Dialect, and I'm John Peters Coleman, wishing you a very good week from the team in Queen Square Studio in Bristol City Centre. Thank you for your company, and see you next week. Bye-bye!